When I was younger, we had a lounge in our house, which many people do, I'm sure. And in that lounge, there was a couple of settees and a big chair. The big chair was my dad's chair. Anyone could sit on the settees, but the big chair was my dad's chair. On my dad's chair was a TV controller holder, a coffee cup holder, and a newspaper holder. Everything was there on the chair. The chair was the best position in the room, great proximity to chat to people and to watch the television, of high importance. And it was the most comfortable chair in the whole room. Now, my sister and I could sit on the chair. In fact, we used to love to sit on the chair. But when my dad was home, when he wasn't away working, we knew it was his chair. And we didn't sit on it. Not because he would have found that he'd had a go at us at all, but it was his chair. It was an unspoken agreement in our house, but we all knew whose chair it was and who was supposed to sit on it. And I don't think that's unique to our household, having been to other people's houses, because although there may not be any rules laid down, there may not be any reserved signs on the seating, there is often an order to where we sit in a house, even if it's unspoken, and we'll say to people, no, 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 you can sit anywhere. There is often an order. We all have our favourite chair of one sort or another. And we may swap around, of course. We may try a different chair, but we generally gravitate to the one that we prefer. And it becomes particularly important the older you get, I've realised. My grandma, when she was quite old, had one of those chairs that, you know, all singing, all dancing. Press the button, you could lie back, you could be catapulted out if you so wished. All different attachments, you know, I don't know whether it actually vibrated, I'm not sure, it did many things. And, you know, we all had a go, we all sat in the chair, woo, look at this! And, you know, everything, but it was my grandma's chair, because she needed it, and she sat in it. Now, ironically, it belongs to my dad. He has a new chair. Has all the TV stuff, but he now goes backwards. Brilliant. Because you see, the thing is, although chairs are just things that we sit on, they also say a great deal about who we are. In fact, in the business world, they're a symbol of status, in a way. If you've just started in a company, you're likely to get the chair that someone else had, because you're not important enough to have your own chair. However, if you're the CEO or similar, you get to choose. You get to choose your all singing, all dancing, extremely comfortable and powerful chair. The importance is clear, purely because of the chair you sit on. I don't know whether any of you watched the visit of Barack Obama to Great Britain this week, but if you did, you may have noticed, consciously or subconsciously, the importance of the chairs in that visit. All the chairs that Barack Obama sat on were slightly larger, slightly more comfortable, and slightly more embellished than everyone else's chair, even the Prime Minister's. Because I guess he's the President of the United States, he's visiting. He needs to have the most important chair. There was one exception, of course, and that was the Queen, who had an even better chair. And I guess, you know, when we talk about the Queen, we enter a whole new realm of the importance of chairs. Because the Queen, of course, is royalty. And tradition states that royalty not only sit on larger, more comfortable and more embellished chairs, they also predominantly sit on thrones, royal thrones, which are hugely significant in themselves, because not only are they chairs, but they're also often surrounded by, or ordained, or emblazoned with signs of the ruling power, the ruling monarch of the time. Signs of influence, signs of authority, whether it be historical, past authority, or whether it be real authority of the time, because they're royal, and their throne, their chair, speaks of that royalty that they have, so that everyone can see the importance
that they hold.
And it's interesting because this sense of a throne as an indicator of power and authority has been around for years. Of course it has, it's not a new thing. In fact, it's a long-standing feature of our world. It goes right back to the ancient world, to the times of the Bible, and the cultures that thrived in and around those times, where thrones were of very high importance, not just for sitting on, but to the point where they were seen as the central symbol of a person's kingship. The throne was all important. They were often surrounded, as today, by images and pictures of power and authority, as well as being emblazoned with gold and ornamented with precious, expensive decorations. All of this, of course, indicating the glorious reign of the person who sat on the throne. But the thrones of the day, back in the ancient world, were not just there to confirm royalty, to talk about power. They were also seen as something more. They were also seen as a sign of the kind of rule that the reigning power would impose. So, for instance, when a new king, and it would have been a king, came to the throne, people would automatically ask the question, how will they reign? What will they be like? How will this new kingdom work? Of course, they'd soon find out by how the person did reign, but more importantly, as a sign of the basis of this reign, the characteristics of the kingship were carved into the base of the throne. So you'd have all the decoration and you'd have all the things surrounding the throne, but in the base of the throne, you would have carved the foundations on which this kingship would be based. Often it would create a picture of an amazing throne which showed power and glory and authority. So when we turn to Psalm 97, the beginning of it that I read earlier, we can see that the psalmist, in seeking to describe God's kingship, God's power, God's authority, God's glory, uses the image of a throne to convey what it might be like. And by all accounts, when we take a look at the picture, it's pretty terrifying. Because here in Psalm 97, not only is the throne, the glory of God, shrouded in thick darkness, indicating that this glory is by far too terrifying to see, but it's also preceded by frightening phenomena. For instance, as I read, it says, there is fire that goes before him and consumes his foes on every side. There is lightning that lights up the world, and in its wake the earth trembles. There is also the amazing phenomenon that the mountains melt like wax as the throne of the Lord appears. And this is only 5 verses of description. It says quite a lot. If you want a longer and more terrifying image, you can turn to the first chapter of Ezekiel, which gives us much more, as Ezekiel tries to describe the coming of the throne of God. He uses similar images, as the throne is preceded by a violent storm with flashing lightning, brilliant lights, and glowing metal. But then Ezekiel goes a step further as he tries to describe in detail what's going on. He talks about living creatures which surround the throne with 4 faces and 4 wings, whose appearance is like burning coals of fire or like torches. And then he describes there being a giant wheel on the ground beside each creature, which moves as the creatures move and rises as the creatures rise. And above their heads is what looks like a vault sparkling like crystal and awesome. And this is all before the throne of God has appeared. There's this amazing array of creatures and signs and symbols. When you read it in full, which... give it a go, Ezekiel chapter 1. It's an amazingly complex picture, but it's basically describing what the glory of God might look like. And as it's only a description, what Ezekiel sees is probably far from the glory of God, because he couldn't really describe it. It's a glimpse, just as Psalm 97 is a glimpse of the arrival of God's throne. So I guess when we finally witness
the throne itself appearing in the picture. We might expect, having seen this display of glory that preceded it and surrounded it, that the basis of the kingship, or if you like, the foundations of the throne of God, would be equally powerful. They would be an indication of his supremacy, of his influence, of his superiority. They'd be a reminder of his dominance over humankind. And yet, when the throne of God appears in Psalm 97, its foundations are surprising. Because instead of words of power and authority, words which confirm this glorious picture that's been described, the foundations of the throne of God, the basis upon which his kingship will function, are words of ethical conduct, righteousness, justice, words which talk about relationship, human interaction, morality, words that in many ways seem contrary to the display that has preceded them. It reminds me of those old buildings which have been converted into something different to what they were. When I lived in London, there was a building which had a lovely picture on it, and above it, it said the Fisher Bookbinding Company. But it was actually a block of flats. But it still had that inscription on it, because that's what it used to be, and it was a beautiful inscription. There's a lot of buildings like that. There's one around the corner from me that was a church, and that was also turned into flats. And one of the doors for one of the flats had the vestry written over it. Clearly it wasn't the vestry, it was someone's house. But it was still said as the vestry, because that's what it used to be. And you know, there's a danger when we look at the throne of God in Psalm 97 that we take the words justice and righteousness to simply be decorative inscriptions, like those that are left on walls or left on buildings, but they no longer mean what the building is used for. And you know, not that these words don't mean anything, because we know that God is just and God is righteous. But there's a danger that we no longer hold these qualities to be foundational to his reign. We don't see them as utterly important. And yet, if we don't hold them as foundational, we lose sight of what God's kingdom is really like. Because you see, God himself holds these qualities as foundational to who he is and what his kingdom will be like. We know this because if we look in the Old Testament at the book of Amos, God actually turns away from his people. He rejects their sacrifices, he rejects their festivals, because the people are not living in a way that is just and right, because they're treating each other as if they don't matter. And so God rejects them. And then, of course, if we look at the book of Micah, also in the Old Testament, where the people of God are coming to him and offering him ridiculous sacrifices as worship, he says, I don't want your sacrifices. I don't want your extravagance. I don't want your rituals. Instead, this is what I want. I want you to act justly. I want you to love mercy. And I want you to walk humbly with your God. Because you see, the true foundations of his kingship, of the kingdom of God, are not power-wielding elements. They're not judgment, condemnation, and oppression. They're not displays of authority so that people will quake in their boots. They are justice and righteousness. And that's what makes God so glorious. Justice and righteousness. Not forced power and a stern tone if we do something wrong, but the desire that all people will know the justice of God. And they'll find freedom in that justice. And we catch a glimpse of how this justice works, don't we? When Jesus enters our world, when God comes to walk among us, not to judge, but to bring the kingdom of justice. Justice for the woman
who is bleeding, who no one has talked to or looked at for years. Justice for the people who Zacchaeus cheated and stole from. Justice for the woman caught in adultery who people want to stone, and Jesus stops it. Justice for those people who were refused entry to the temple because they couldn't afford to buy expensive sacrifices, and Jesus turned the tables over so that they could enter the house of God. Justice for those who were oppressed and sidelined and ignored. And also when Jesus came, he condemned those who were unjust. He condemned the Pharisees, the teachers of the law and the Sadducees, because they knew the foundations of God's throne, and yet they were ignoring them, piling onto people things they should do, rules they should obey, instead of opening the way for them to get to God. Because you see, our God is a God of justice and righteousness. This is who he is. Not who he wants to be or who we hope he'll be, but who he is. These are his foundations. If they weren't, he wouldn't be the glorious God that we worship today. Do you know, there's a story in a book called Just Give Me Jesus by Anne Graham Lotz, Billy Graham's daughter, if you are aware of her. And it goes like this. The story is told of a man who, while walking down the street of his town, passed the window of a local pet store. He could see a giant iguana sunning itself on a rock, furry kittens tumbling head over heel as they kickboxed a small toy back and forth, and doe-eyed puppies excitedly yapping at the kittens. But what caught the man's attention and caused him to stop and stare was the most magnificent bird he had ever seen. It sat regally on a perch in the middle of the window display, hauntily preening its beautiful feathers. Its head was a shimmering cobalt blue, its wings an iridescent yellow, its throat ruby red, fading into a misty rose on its chest. The beak and feet gleamed ebony black, as did the fierce, intelligent eyes. The man couldn't resist. Inside the pet store, he noticed a sign posted near the bird that said in large block letters, "This bird is guaranteed to sing." He inquired as to the price and was told he could own the bird for $1,000, which would include the cage. The man gasped. But in spite of the shock, he paid the price and proudly took the bird in its cage home. The rest of the day he watched and waited, eagerly anticipating the bird's song. By the next morning, the bird still had not sung. So the man returned to the pet store. "What could be wrong?" he asked. The clerk apologised. "Sir, didn't I tell you the bird needs a ladder? He'll climb the ladder and then he'll sing." The man bought the ladder for $25, took it home, put it in the birdcage and waited expectantly to hear the bird sing. The bird climbed the ladder but sat at the top in silence. The next morning, the man returned to the pet store and told the clerk the bird still had not sung. The clerk apologised again and said, "I'm sorry, I forgot. He needs a little bell. He will climb the ladder and ring the bell, then he will sing." The bell cost $25. Back home went the man, put it on top of the ladder in the bird's cage. The bird climbed the ladder, rang the bell, but that was the only sound that came out of the cage. The next morning, he returned to the pet store. This time, he learned the bird needed a $20 mirror beside the bell. Back at home, the bird climbed the ladder, rang the bell, looked in the mirror, but didn't even chirp. The next morning, the man strolled resolutely into the pet store. He pounced on the clerk and angrily recounted his purchase, totaling $1,075 for a bird that didn't sing. The clerk answered that the bird would definitely sing if the man installed a $25 swing in the birdcage. The man pounded his fist on the counter as he paid for the swing and warned that if this didn't work, he would return the bird and expect a full refund. The man stormed back to his house, put the swing in place, crossed his arms and stared at the bird. Sure enough, the bird climbed the ladder, rang the bell, looked into the mirror and swung on the swing. Then
It fell to the bottom of the cage, dead. The man was aghast.
He grabbed the cage with the dead bird, took it back to the pet store, slammed it on the counter and yelled hysterically at the clerk, "I bought a bird for $1,000, a ladder for 20, a bell for 25, a mirror for 30 and a swing for 25. Not only does the bird not sing, but it's dead. What went wrong?"
"Oh," the clerk responded, "did I forget to tell you, he also needs birdseed." And you see, the thing is, we talk about God. We say how amazing he is, what amazing things he does. But if we forget that at the heart of God is justice for people and righteous ways of living, then we treat him as a God who is dead. Because this is who he is, a loving, just, and righteous God. This is his heart for every single person, for situations in our world. These are his foundations. This is the kingdom that he has come to bring. And this is good news for us and for other people.